The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Case one from the Blue Cliff Record. Emperor Wu of Liang asked the great master Bodhidharma, "What is the highest meaning of the holy truths?" Bodhidharma said, "Empty, without holiness." The emperor said, "Who is facing me?" Bodhidharma said, "I don't know." The emperor did not understand. After this, Bodhidharma crossed the Yangtze River and came to the kingdom of Wei. Later, the emperor brought up this matter with Master Qi and asked him about it. Master Qi asked, "Does your majesty know who this man is?" The emperor said, "I don't know." Master Qi said, "He is the Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, transmitting the Buddha mind seal." The emperor felt regretful, so he wanted to send an emissary to go invite Bodhidharma to return. Master Qi told him, "Your majesty, don't say that you will send someone to fetch him back. Even if everyone in the whole country were to go after him, he still wouldn't return." So here in Worcester, yesterday's storm has subsided, and today a gentle rain falls. It's been a dry summer, and Michael at the temple has spent numerous hours carrying watering cans, nurturing the different plants. And all of us gardeners have been concerned, so dry. And today, just rain. Just the falling of these drops everywhere here. No place is neglected. The rain, someone said, the rain falls on the just and the unjust. And the quality of mercy is like the rain that falls from the heavens. We too, here in the rain of our practice. Sometimes stormy, sometimes fierce winds blow, sometimes tornado warnings, and we are told to head for the basement. And sometimes just gentle, imperceptible. We wonder if anything is happening. In our sutra service, we read the lovely passage from Dogen, Yuibutsu Yobutsu, that spoke of the impossibility of conceiving of what we are doing. He said, any idea you have of awakening is actually not a help to awakening. So many things in this life require a certain amount of thoughtfulness and planning. You want to accomplish a certain thing, or you want to take a trip. You need to plan your trip. Where are you going? Buy your tickets, make your reservations. Or to build a table, you buy the lumber and cut things up and have a plan. And then at the end, you can look, wow, a wonderful table, or look, here we are in Dublin, in Copenhagen, in Worcester. We travel around and we move through our life. And this is so important, this capacity to think and to plan. It's what has allowed you to be here at this retreat. You had to make your plans. You have to make sure you have the link for the meeting, create the space and time. And so we bring this mind to practice. Of course, we hear something and we think, well, that sounds good. I want that. And we have some image that brings us here. Maybe we heard the stories, heard some story or read some book, and something touched us. And we said, I want to look into this further. This is what we're doing, looking into it further. But as we look into it further, just like scientists who look further and further into the nature of things, into the workings of things, are almost always surprised. Physicists who look into the nature of reality find that there are no things. It looks smaller and smaller and smaller, and at the smallest level, not things, just probabilities, just vibration, only movement. The Buddha once said, things are not as they appear, nor are they otherwise. So our everyday understanding, everyday mind, planning and heading off in some direction, so important. But on the most important matters, these matters of life and death, the matter of accomplishing your life, we are up against some great mystery. These ultimate questions of life and death, of meaning and purpose, cannot be solved by being more thoughtful. And we give these Dharma talks, and we have Dharma dialogues, and we look into the matter, and words are so important to point us in the direction. And yet, any idea you have of what it is, this awakening, any idea you have of Buddha, of the Dharma, are not it. Lin Chi said in the reading we did this morning, there is no Buddha, no Dharma, no practice, no enlightenment. And in this meeting between Bodhidharma and the emperor, this famous story, and as Melissa mentioned, this story appeared quite a while after the Buddha was reported to have lived in the 6th century. It was in the 8th century, around 750, that this story of the meeting between Bodhidharma and the emperor first appeared. And it actually appeared in a fundraising speech given by someone who was encouraging people to make donations to the Sangha, to the Dharma. But something about this story rings so true and has rung true over centuries. Something of this meeting of the emperor, most powerful person in the land, and Bodhidharma, this legendary figure who brought Zen from India to China. And in the fuller story, the first question the emperor asks is, he says, I have built many monasteries and supported the Dharma. I have given my life to the Dharma. What merit is there? And Bodhidharma says, no merit. And then he goes on. But this first question we might think as quite arrogant. Maybe we imagine the emperor being quite proud. Look what I've done. Aren't I a good person? But as we dream into these koan, into these stories, so many different ways to enter. And as I've been sitting with the emperor and Bodhidharma, like you have, I wonder if the emperor maybe was coming from a very different place. Maybe he had devoted his life to the Dharma, to serving the Dharma, and yet he was deeply troubled. He was not at peace. And maybe he was saying, I've done all this, and still my mind is unquiet. Still, is there any value? Those moments, maybe when we look at our life and what we've done, and we say, wow, not enough. I haven't done what I think I should have done. I haven't been brave enough. I haven't been successful enough. I haven't been constant enough. You know, the judge that comes in. And we can be quite despairing. And so maybe the emperor was despairing. And Bodhidharma does not say, no, that's good, good to do good things. And of course, being kind, being nice, working hard, all wonderful things. But Bodhidharma says, no merit. And then what is the holy, the essence of the holy teaching? No holiness. And who are you? No knowing, no merit, no holiness, no knowing. This is quite a stark and steep teaching, and can appear quite harsh on one level. He was not trying to fix the emperor, not trying to invite him to feel more at ease. In fact, he was disturbing the emperor. He was taking away any place to stand. This taking away, of course, is in some ways what our life is about. Everything you have will be taken away, guaranteed. Everything you possess, all your relationships, all of your things, all of your accomplishments, in some way, we have to give them all back. Alan's wonderful invitation last night of entering into this not knowing. Whatever story we tell about ourselves is so partial. And is only temporary anyway. This matter of life and death, so urgent for us human beings. We appear to be the only organisms that have a sense of our death. And of course, we can't imagine our death because we are here, always here, always have been here. And I think there is a tendency to want to gather things to protect the self. Maybe if I get enough money, maybe if I get recognized by enough people, maybe if I get wise enough. And so we accumulate. And part of us just does this naturally. And when we come to practice, maybe we bring this mind of accumulation. So I'm going to remember everything that's said, and I will remember this saying, and I will remember that saying, and I will hold on to this, and I will make sure I don't forget that. And pretty soon we're carrying so much what seemed liberating and leading to freedom just weighs us down even more. We become ridden with Buddhism. Zen becomes the weight that we lug around. And so Bodhidharma and other teachers encourage us, Lin Chi, Dogen, encourage us to another way of being. And this other way of being cannot be described, it cannot be fabricated. We might say, this is the ground of being. This is the life that is not the life that you think it is, because it cannot be limited or contained. But it can be lived and appreciated. It can be relied on. This mysterious, wondrous, unfabricated Dharma, we call it. And as Melissa pointed out yesterday, all kinds of names for it, but Hey You will do just as well as anything we might argue over. So we are invited into a world beyond right and wrong. Sometimes we use the word emptiness. This morning we also read James Ford's rendition of the Heart Sutra. James Ford, of course, one of the co-founders of Boundless Way with Melissa and me, and a wonderful human being still alive, very much alive and kicking out on the West Coast. But in this a wonderful rendition, not an exact translation, but I think some of James' wonderful kindness appears. He continually uses the word boundlessness rather than emptiness. I think boundlessness, as he uses it and as we might use it here, maybe helps us release our grip, our opinion. Emptiness sounds rather cold and dark to me. But boundlessness implying something with no edges. And he says, understanding this boundlessness, the pure-hearted one is free. Understanding this boundlessness, the pure-hearted one is free. Speaking of the freedom of Zen, we might say awakening to the freedom of each moment. But how do we understand this boundlessness? Because any of the tools we have for understanding are not big enough, not of the scale and scope. Bodhidharma is inviting the emperor into this vivid world. this world that has no boundaries, no edges, this world, this true life that is not somewhere else. In the Heart Sutra, this core teaching of Zen, over and over, boundlessness is all things, and all things are no other than boundlessness. So we're not talking about two different worlds here. We're talking about dimensions of this world, surprising dimensions of this world, because when something appears, it appears to be what it is. When we have a problem, when we someone insults us, when we are lost in a mind state that we really, really don't like, or when we are confused, feeling disconnected, so easy to go into the mind of judging, and it's quite clear this could not be it. Because how do you know this could not be it? Well, because I want to feel differently. I do not want to feel this. Thank you very much. Zen invites us to not make judgments, or to not make judgments about our judgments. The first teaching of the Buddha, that discomfort, that suffering is unavoidable. This is the teaching that we have all encountered. We don't always get what we want. And sometimes we get what we don't want. And our initial strategy as we grow up, I think most of us, is trying to control more and more, trying to control the world around us, trying to make sure the people around us think of us the way we would like them to think of us. But as we grow older, as we look into life itself, through practice or just through looking at life, it begins to be very clear that you are not in charge, that I am not in charge. And as we sit, we can see that things keep changing. One of the wonderful things about Sesshin is that we can travel through all the different realms, through very difficult and painful places, and sometimes through places of great calm and ease, maybe sometimes just sitting, listening to the sound of the rain or the sound of the traffic, or the coolness or the warmth of the breeze on your cheek. And for some moments, maybe many moments, no problem, no separation, no gap. And then immediately a gap comes in and we think, oh, this is it. This is what I want. How do I hold on to this? And immediately there's the separation. This is not the defect. My grandfather had a workbench in the basement, and had all of these wonderful tools. And when my brother and I were young, we used to go down to the basement and pull out the tools. And they were somehow some kind of iconic thing for me. I don't know what it was, but they were his tools, and they were a way of relating to the world, of getting things done. And I remember he had a pair of pliers, and they were the kind of pliers that have two settings. You can make them very small or very big. And I decided that this was a defect that I was going to correct. I was going to fix his pair of pliers. Fortunately for him and for me, I never fixed the pliers, and they always had this wonderful feature. But so often we encounter our life as the defect that we will fix. And once I get rid of feeling like this, then I'll really get into my zazen. Once I'm no longer confused, once I know what the essence of the teaching is, once I know who I am. Zen invites us to a wilder and more vivid kind of life. Zen is not for the faint of heart. My teacher used to say, to follow this path of Zen, you have to be willing to tolerate many weird mind states. Now, whether you follow the path of Zen or not, I guarantee you will encounter many weird mind states. This is how it is for us human beings. And we may look at other people and think, oh, well, you know, she seems quite placid and calm, seems like she knows what's going on, or he seems to have it together. But of course, everyone is like you. Everyone is pretty nutty. Everyone is volatile in their own way. Everyone lives inside a world that is constantly changing, where everything is coming and going. And so our vow in Zen, our bodhisattva vow to save all beings, we might say to be present to life in whatever form it takes. This is quite easy sometimes, and feels nearly impossible other times. But these places that are so difficult, these places where we might say problems arise in our practice, or we get stuck again and again, falling into discouragement, or again and again falling into whatever it is we fall into. The path of Zen is not about not falling. You will be taken over again and again. You will be abducted into dark realms, and you will be abducted into heavenly realms. And everyday realms, continually shifting, shape-shifting, now this and now that. And this path of Zen is not about accumulating wisdom, as we were saying yesterday, not about step by step, well, now I'm at the bluebird level, and now I'm flying up to the cardinal level. There is only this moment. And of course, we grow in love and understanding, and as we practice, there can be some stability that we encounter and some way we learn to trust breathing in and breathing out. But yet, every moment, we are beginners. Every moment we are invited and required to give up everything we have, to give up our opinion, to give up any insight, to abandon stories about who we were, notice the stories of who we are and who we will be. These stories are not bad, and you cannot stop making those stories, but we can learn to hold them more lightly. The thoughts, the images, the feelings, the sensations come and go, and this coming and going, this reactivity, this ease, is all a piece of human life. And this moment contains every other moment. Every moment, as Melissa said yesterday, every moment of your life has been required to lead up to and is here, and every moment of the future also here. This present moment is not some little dot on a line that extends behind you and in front of you. This moment is all of life itself. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are here. Bodhidharma did not go to the kingdom of Wei. How could Bodhidharma go anywhere? There is no Buddha outside you. There is no Bodhidharma outside you. There is no awakening or practice or delusion anywhere else. The organizational consultant Margaret Wheatley has written a number of books. Her favorite that she wrote, I think in the 80s, maybe 90s, called A Simpler Way. And she talks about thinking of the world not so much as a trial to be mastered or some challenge to be overcome, but as a kind of playful arising and all kinds of arising. And she says that oftentimes we think there are windows of opportunity. We might think that the emperor had a window of opportunity with Bodhidharma, and then that window is gone, and oh well, too bad. But she maintained, and I think I do as well, every moment is a window of opportunity. And we might say not a moment, but the moment, the window of opportunity you have been waiting for. Lin Chi says, is there anything lacking? So inviting us all to rely on this boundlessness, to penetrate, to enter into boundlessness, to give ourselves, to fall back into boundlessness, to float, sink, rise, doesn't matter. All the time, this boundlessness has carried you. This life that you are a part of. There is not some life you have been born into, but the life that is you, always shining brightly in the darkness, in the light, in the rainstorm, in the gentle rain, in the sunshine, all the different conditions. Invite us as we are encouraging each other to stay here. Some of these mind states are truly terrifying and quite difficult to abide. And we are training ourselves to stay here, to cultivate this curiosity, to open our hearts not just to what we think it should be, but to open our hearts and our minds to everything, not a single thing excluded. And this is the boundlessness, no merit, no awakening, no arising, no abiding. Just this. So Emperor Wu of Liang asked the great master Bodhidharma, what is the highest meaning of the holy truths? Bodhidharma said, empty, without holiness. The emperor said, who is facing me? Bodhidharma said, I don't know. The emperor did not understand. After this, Bodhidharma crossed the Yangtze River and came to the kingdom of Wei. Later, the emperor brought this up to Master Qi and asked him about it. Master Qi asked, does your majesty know who this man is? The emperor said, I don't know. Master Qi said, he is the Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, transmitting the Buddha mind seal. The emperor felt regretful, so he wanted to send an emissary to go invite Bodhidharma to return. Master Qi told him, your majesty, don't say you will send someone to fetch him back. Even if everyone in the whole country were to go after him, he still wouldn't return. Thank you. Please sit comfortably. And we'll move into our Dharma dialogue. And encouraging everyone to step forward. Some of us do so quite easily. Others of us are more reticent. But coming forth with what is so, your understanding, your lack of understanding, where this all catches you. And Melissa and Alan and I will respond. Tom.
Hi. Pushing that raise the hand, there's always, you don't know if there's going to be six that come up before. But anyway, really loved the talk. The whole Melissa's yesterday, the teaching, all of it, it's just so, I feel really grateful and blessed, really. There's one phrase that you mentioned that the Buddha said, things are not as they appear, nor are they otherwise. Just
yeah, he said that for you, Tom.
Well, thank you for saying that. No, it's like always trying to find the little, oh, this worked, you know, that worked. This is what it is. That's how it appears. But it's also not like that at all. So then, and one more real quick thing. You mentioned curiosity. That to be curious about what is this? What's really happening? Thank you.
Wonderful. That phrase got me when I first heard it too many years ago, and it's coincidentally from a sutra that was Bodhidharma's favorite. The one, well, according to the legend, it's the only one. He was not into studying sutras, according to his legend, but this one, the Lankavatara Sutra, was the one he recommended to everybody. And it became a very important foundational Zen text in China. And yeah, I used to have it when I had a website of my own. That was what you found when you clicked on the website. Because I thought, right, things really are the way they are, and they're not.
Yeah.
I mean, you can turn it all around. It's but you use the word also. I think that's so important because we have minds that tend to make this or that. We do a lot of oring, right? But anding and alsoing, that allows us to experience this boundlessness.
Yeah.
That is one of our, it's the heritage of Zen. It goes way back, even to the Indian ancestors.
Great. Thank you, Tom. Don.
I thank you for the talk. One of my favorite lines that I like to remember is like, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. I love that one. To just, yeah, just the yesterday's realization is today's delusion type stuff. They're good reminders for me. And it, additionally, I am having trouble both like not doing it and or with I am sitting here quietly and comfortably, but I should be out fighting, you know, because the world's on fire and there's so many people suffering. So it's like almost like it's sitting here quietly and feeling comfy. Isn't doing that, I guess. But it is in many ways. I am told it doesn't feel like it at the moment, though.
Yeah. Thanks, Don, for both those points and for reminding us of this world on fire. We are not sitting in some kind of vacuum or some kind of perfect world or where things appear to be going well. And of course, this is the world Buddhist practitioners have always practiced in. And I think in some ways is why we dedicate our practice, you know, so practicing, Don, not just for you or me, not just for me, but for each other and for this whole suffering world. People are encountering terrible violence and terrible things, and we're not encountering that right now, but we are encountering something. And are we willing to be courageous in our own life? Not think, well, I hope those people are courageous, but how do I meet all of the wildness that arises in me, and can I sit upright in the middle of it, here for me, for all of us. Yeah.
And I think too, there's another helpful word substitution, because the word but is like or, right? It could it include, and I have to say that I'm a little jealous of you being so comfy. I don't find this practice so comfy all the time. Sometimes it is, and it's nice when that's true. But I feel like what I'm doing personally is encountering all these really difficult things internally when I take the backward step, so that when I go out and am part of a protest or a letter writing campaign or something to help to heal the world that's on fire, I come from that capacity that I've been developing to open to suffering. Because I know so many people who are activists who burn out or can't do it. I mean, it just, so the pain just gets them. And I wish they had a practice like this, but there's the but again. And it's not my business to make everybody practice Zen. And it's even not my business to encourage all of you to turn towards your own suffering. I know that for me, that's the core of my own activism. But let's see what yours is. You're going to find a way that's uniquely Dawn's, because you're a unique person. And how is that going to flower and manifest? How will this become the seed of that? Mm-hmm. I'm excited to see.
Thanks, Don. Marcus.
Yeah, thank you for the talk, David. I think when you were saying talking about, wanting to gather possessions, loved ones, things to kind of confirm to an identity, only to have to give them back in the end. It kind of just sparked an interesting thought. I was kind of coming across why, if I knew I had, whether it was 12 days left to live or 200 or 1,000, why would that instantly spark, an urgency to live and kind of knowing that there's a countdown instead of, gravitating towards that anyways. There is a countdown. I just don't know that exact date, but why having a fictitious or knowing number would that all of a sudden, boy, I gotta now do this. There's no more time. And kind of it just popped into my head as you were kind of discussing that.
Yeah, I think this issue of death, life and death, we say, we can pretend. We live in a culture that helps us pretend, live forever, work out, eat the right food. But this awareness of death, awareness of the brevity of our life, I think for all of us spurs us to go deeper. Yeah. Great. Thank you, Marcus.
And I just want to add, it's not so much when we die. You were talking about all these different possible time spans, but it's that we die, right? That we know. And I love how Thoreau says in Walden that he didn't want to come to die and realize that he had not lived. So what we want is, no matter how much time we have left, we want to fully live our lives. It doesn't matter if it's a day or if it's 20 more years or 40 more years. There's that invitation to actually be alive while we're alive. And so maybe not even so much worrying about death as just remembering, I'm alive now. What do I want to do with that? What an amazing opportunity.
And at the same time, how about dying right now? Why wait till some future time when you can die on the cushion in your chair? Die to how you want it to be. Die to how you think it should be. All of this together.
I was thinking the same thing. There's a Christian saint named Abraham of Santa Clara who said it was one of those pithy sayings that like that Lankavatara Sutra quote, the one who dies before they die, when they die, will not die. And it's this kind of dying that Zen offers us, both the aliveness that Alan was just pointing to, that we've all been pointing to, and also this seeing through the way the self prevents the idea of a self, these constructions, they're so blinding and so limited. And the reality is that there's no limitation. And so to die before we die is that gives us a lot of freedom. Don't believe
And
this, but I would say and. Dot dot dot.
it's no small matter. I mean, I always like to read about other people dying to the self, but when it's me, it's quite a thing. And for all of us here, we are, in a sense, every time we do Zazen, we are dying to our preference for comfort, right? We are saying there's something more important than being comfortable. Great, thank you. Neve.
Thank you for the talk. One of the things that spoke to me was this thing of accumulating knowledge as a form of protection. And that felt really poignant. Knowledge about Buddhism and knowledge about the world on fire, the climate, all of the things and I've been walking that line, particularly with regard to climate, and it's like this boundary between care and wanting to be saved by the knowledge or protected by the knowledge. And being here and away from all that knowledge through my phone or my laptop or whatever is a kind of a death as well. That is
yes,
very revealing and tender and very welcome. You know, not easy, but it feels very very reliable.
Well, and all of us here on retreat, we have died to our everyday self, you know, for these 3 days. We have stepped back from what we do. And I love you pointing out this middle way, so we can start off, all right, I'm going to find out about it so that I can do something about it. And then the activity takes over, and what was liberating becomes an encumbrance, right? So how to, and yet to say, well, I'm just not going to read anything because, it, you know, it's not that. So not a fixed position, not a fixed way, and stepping forward and stepping back, this is the way. Yeah. Thank you. Pierce.
Thank you, David. I enjoyed your name for what it is we're doing. This kind of throwaway name. You said, "Oh, we might as well call it Hey You." I love that. I mean, the first thing that came to me was this is the name of an iconic Pink Floyd song. Ironically enough, from the album called The Wall, not Bodhidharma's Wall, but we're all facing the wall. And I like the fact that you coupled it with Linji's, there is no Buddha, no Dharma, no practice, no realization. I love to think about Linji's monks sitting there. They've all come for something, you know, they want something. And here he takes it all away and throws it back at them. And in some sense, you know, this is a koan that takes it all away. The emperor has his feet cut off at the knees. And yet, you know, even though the koan doesn't dwell on it, there's something there for him when the other guy tells him, you know, he's never going to come back. So put that in your pipe and smoke it. And so, you know, you also mentioned that everything is taken away. And so it all comes back. It all comes down to you. It all comes down to you all and me. I think this is a wonderful wake up call. Hey, you. Thank you.
Yeah. thank you, Pierce. So many things we can call it. And this taking everything away that appears to be a death and is a kind of death, but allows us, is the cost of entry into something beyond our imagination, right? This true life, the true self, beyond any rank, far beyond, gate, paragate, right? This is where we're pointing to. Yeah.
There's the koan about the monk whose name I forget for the moment, but David or Melissa might remember, who goes off to live in the mountains alone and every morning calls himself, right? And
Ruyan.
Ruyan calls himself master. Yes. And so I'm imagining him saying, hey, you.
Yeah, what?
And what, you know, so we actually have that practice in so how wonderful. And yeah, just simplifying it, boiling it down to that, just hey, Pierce, yeah, I'm here.
I can't resist adding that in Kerouac's The Dharma Bums, when Kerouac goes up to the mountain to be a ranger, a forest ranger, and thinks of it as a kind of a retreat, one of the guys who's helping him carry his supplies up there says something like, don't worry about anything. The only thing you got to worry about is when you start talking to yourself.
Okay.
Yeah, when we don't have to worry about that in Zen, clearly,
Probably not.
the many parts of the self.
Yeah.
Actually, I think what he said was it's not a problem when you start talking to yourself. It's a problem when you start to answer yourself.
Okay. And both also true.
Uh-oh, I'm in trouble. Madhu.
Enjoying all your conversations and the pointers. I'm also thinking, what a relief, you know, what a relief to have this teaching, right? Bodhidharma's teaching and the teaching of no merit, nothing holy. And I find that whenever I come to teachers with this conventional way of thinking, and whenever I'm stuck, and when I come to one of you, and you know, I'm like, you know, worried or anxious, and whenever it gets pointed out, like, you know, there is no merit, or it doesn't work like that, like, you know, it's like I get this chance to immediately drop everything right there. And you know,
Yeah.
yeah, and also reminds me how we can get in our own way sometimes, right? Like,
Sometimes.
yeah, most of the time. So we all are powerful beings, like, we have so much light, but sometimes we can also get scared of that and how that can stand in our way. So this becomes a way for me to, you know, sometimes when I'm on my own way, when I'm overthinking, and then, you know, I get to drop that right there. Yeah. So thank you.
I am so touched by what you say, partly because when we point these things out as teachers, not everybody just drops it all right there. There's a reactivity, a kind of clinging, even though I believe that people are hungry for that pointing out. It's also really painful. Because we, you know, I was so moved by what Neve said about the accumulation of knowledge around current events is a way of protecting ourselves. Only a group of Zen Buddhists would nod when somebody says that, because it doesn't really make that much logical sense, but it really makes heart sense because of the longing for freedom that we all have. And then we get to see the clinging. You know, we say, oh, but I need to know all this stuff. I need to do it. I need to subject myself to this. And so maybe not, maybe just enough information to inform and allow us to be moved to act, but not to keep accumulating, right? And so your response, Madhu, to that pointing out is not that usual. It's most of us are put up the walls right then and go, yeah, but, you know. And I think when I'm talking to myself, and you know, like Kerouac, and I answer myself, the one who answers is much wiser usually than the one who speaks out. You know, to really listen to the part of ourselves that knows this is true and trust that and see how we get in our own way. I think I've mentioned many times that Alan Watts, who was a great writer about Zen and Buddhism, but also struggled with practicing, his autobiography is called In My Own Way, which is a double meaning, right? He was always in his own way of his life to the end. And he was a really he did his own thing too. So yeah, there's just to see that the pointing out doesn't automatically change it. The awareness is its own action, we say, but the awareness sometimes is so painful that we grab onto all the other protections before we'll do anything to be free.
You know, and that these are teachings of liberation. And when they penetrate into our heart, it's not terrible and we don't disappear. And there can be such a sense of, oh, right. So really appreciating this possibility. Yes, dying to the self, and yes, so painful and all this. And also at the same time, oh, come home. You don't have to struggle already here. Yeah. So maybe last one, Esther.
Thank you so much for the talk, David, and thank you so much for the Dharma dialogue. I so appreciated all these different selves, all these different beings, not separate from beings in this body right here, and how everyone is sharing generously. What I was struck by in your talk was the taking away. And I was struck by the scientists looking deeper and deeper and deeper into things and finding the smallest things, and after that, a vibration. And if I look at my day today, in and out of exhaustion and not knowing who I am at all or what it is I'm experiencing, and not even, raising my hand, wondering what will I'm not sure what will come out of my mouth. But this comfort in the taking away, the trusting that that vibration will do. And that when we speak about the freedom that sometimes shows up in those places where we don't know at all. Something to rely on in some way.
Yeah, a wonderful, well said, happening right here, this investigation.
I sometimes think of that vibration as bodhicitta, the energy that fills the universe, that is utterly reliable. We don't ha In fact, we don't have to do anything, but we do have to do something to find ourselves in alignment with it, and then let it carry us.
Well, let's allow it to carry us a little further and come back to our Zazen posture for a few more breaths before we move into Kinin.